Okay, let's go back to 1968, the Olympics.
Okay.
In Mexico.
Right.
I was sitting in my hometown on the riverbank, listening on a transistor radio to the final of the 1500 meters, and really, let's face it, was down to Jim Ryan and Kip Kano.
Yeah.
Kip Kano, and of course it was just a great race, and you know the static was coming in, and I was so energized, and I sort of listened to the race, you know. Kino won it, and Ryan was second, and I went away, and I thought, I just said to myself, that is my dream, that is a goal. I'd love to go to the Olympics. I was so energized. Well, you know, 4 years later, in 1972, I lined up in the first round of the 1500 meters. On my right was Jim Ryan. On my left was Kip Kino. How about that for a dream?
Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by ToughManTry.com, by Everyone.org. That's EVERYWN.org, cool new event, half marathon and 5K coming up on December 11th in San Diego by Oska Wellness. And Oska Wellness, brand new product for pain relief. And you can check that out at OskaWellness.com. RunCatalina.com, Catalina Eco Marathon coming up on Saturday, November 19th. And, of course, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $75 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. You can check out any of our interviews on iTunes, on Babbittville.com, and recently went over the 1 million download mark.
My first guest, very excited to have him on with us, running legend, won the gold medal 1500 meters 1976, and 30 years ago became the first athlete to break 350 for the mile, running 349.4 in 1975. John Walker joins me. John, how are you, sir?
Good afternoon, Bob. How are you?
Ah, it's so cool to have you on air with us, Mr. Walker. I'm a huge
Thank
fan
you
of yours.
Just listening to the promo with Rod Dixon.
I've had Rodney on the show many, many times, and
well, the incredible thing is,
yeah.
Rod listened to Kino and the commentary of Kino and Jim Ryan. I listened to Rod Dixon's race on a transistor radio as well.
Did you really?
2 a.m. in the morning. I was so excited when he won his bronze medal.
Now, how far back do you go with Rod?
I go right back to the 70s. Well, 72.
Yeah.
I tried out for the Olympics in 72 at Munich as well in the 800 meter, but I never got the qualifying standard, even though I'd won the New Zealand champs, so I didn't go along.
Oh, that must
but
have
Rod
been.
Rod was probably one of the most gifted athletes around because, I mean, he ran 147.6 for 800 meters,
yep.
And also won the New York Marathon. And that's a very big gap.
That to me, his range was pretty amazing to run that to run fast at 800, win a bronze at 1500, and go sub 209 at the New York City Marathon.
And he should have won the Olympics in 76.
He should have won the Olympics in what in 76? At
5,000.
5,000.
He was favored to win. He came on the shoulder of Viren.
Yes.
Allowed Viren to get away from him. He drifted back to fourth or fifth and came again in the straight. I mean, he should never have allowed that to happen.
And he just got fourth, right? And he just missed the medal.
Yeah, which is not a good place.
No. I was watching video of your gold medal from 76. And the one thing that hit me from watching that is you took the lead, and it looked like towards the end you were cruising a little bit, and those guys.
I wasn't cruising.
But were those guys closer than you thought?
I didn't realize where those guys were. I never really wanted to go with 300 meters to go, but considering the race was very slow, it was a tactical race. There was no natural pacemakers in there because Bailly never ran.
Right.
And considering that I ran 3:34 in the heats and ran 3:39 in the 3:38 in the final.
Well, they went out, what, 62 for the 400
yeah,
and 203 for the
slow half?
Yeah.
But I had guys like Ivo van Dam there who had just run 1:42 for 800 meters and could run 44 for a quarter.
And Walhooter, too.
Rick Walhooter, who was an incredible athlete. I mean, one heck of a talented athlete, had run 1:42, 1:43, and had beaten me in over a mile about 6 months previous. So I took a big risk, but the reason why I went so far out with 300 meters to go, if I'd waited from 200 out, they would have beaten me because they would have outsprinted me.
Right.
But once you get in front, Bob, it's very difficult, and you're running flat out. We ran 37.6 for the last 300.
Oh.
You've got to get up to the guy and get past them, and the guys allowed me to dictate the race because they didn't believe in themselves. I was very beatable on that day.
But sometimes it's funny. Sometimes when you go into a race and you know you're going to win and the other guys think you're going to win, that's a lot of power.
Well, I had a lot of power that day because I'd run the fastest five times in the world. I'd set the world record for 2,000 meters.
Right.
And they were running for second place, and you could see the way they ran. They just allowed me to dictate the race, and thank goodness.
That is good. John, take us through breaking 350. Had that been a goal for you and your coach for a while?
Well, the incredible thing is, Bob, when I was 17 years of age,
yeah,
and hadn't done much running, just a bit of cross-country running, I met my coach, who was Arch Jelly, that's
yeah.
his name, and he sort of come from the Lydia background of mileage and distance running. And he said to me when he saw me run after about a year, you'll be the first person to go close to running under 350 for the mile.
He told you that?
Now, as a young 18-year-old, I mean, that's a lot to comprehend. I never really just went over the top of my head.
He knew that.
But he trained me like that. He didn't train me as a 4-minute miler. He trained me as a sub-350 miler.
And
so when the time came in 1975, I'd won 14 races straight in Europe, broken Peter Snell's New Zealand record.
Right.
And was extremely frustrated that I was running very fast times, around 3:52 for the mile, 3:32 for 1,500, but not actually doing much.
Right.
Because in those days, there weren't any pacemakers. We just had to go out and run by ourselves.
That's right. You didn't have rabbits.
No, we didn't have four rabbits like they do now.
And,
I mean, it's much easier for them to get fast times. I call them Hoover races.
Hoover races?
They just get sucked along.
I love that.
So basically what I did, I broke the New Zealand record for 1,500 metres at 3:32.4,
uh-huh.
running solo in Oslo, and I said to the meet promoter, I want to have a shot at the mile next, because I think I can run by his record at 3:51. So I wrote to her and I said, look, don't tell anybody, keep it secret, I want to change the 1,500 metres to the mile, and I'll come to Gothenburg and run it. Well, when I look back now, Gothenburg wasn't probably the most desirable place to run. 12,000 audience, open-sided stadium, and in a place where they don't really care about too much about track and field.
So
I went there,
yeah.
And I prepared, and it was a relatively slight, windy night. And I'd had a pacemaker. I had a Swedish guy who could hardly speak English. And I said to him, I want you to run to the 800 in 1:55. Well, he ran the first lap in 1:55 and then pulled out after another 100 metres, so that left me by myself. So I wasn't off to a good start. So I went 1:54. So then I had to sort of keep on going.
Right.
But the incredible thing is I was with Rod Dixon 3 days prior to that, and we went down to the track, and the difference between the 1,500 metres and the mile is 120 yards. And I strode 120 yards three times, 15-1, 15-1, 15-1, and I said to Rod, that's what I'm going to finish in. And that was the difference between the world record and the 1,500 metres, and that's what I finished in.
Wow.
So basically it became a solo run. And I won something like by about 150 meters.
Now, what was your thought when, oh, my God, I didn't just break the world record, but I was the first guy to go under 350?
Well, the Norwegians and Swedes are very knowledgeable people, especially the Swedes.
Right.
And when I got across the line, they were still cheering. If I hadn't have broken the world record, there would have been deadly silence.
Right.
So I knew I'd done something. I didn't know how fast I'd run. The world record at the time was 3:51.1, held by Philbert Bailey. He'd just broken Jim Ryan's world record.
Yeah.
And the crowd was still going crazy, and then they announced it under 350.
That's wild.
And my life changed within minutes.
Did it really? How did it change?
Well, I went from basically a guy that could run fast times to unknown to somebody that everybody wanted a piece of. And my first interview was with Time magazine in New York.
Right.
And the lady, I mean, I knew it was going to be a long night because she got on the phone and said to me, now, Mr. Walker, how far is a mile?
Oh, my God.
She said, I know nothing about track and field. Take me through it.
My God.
So there were hundreds of interviews like that. And, I mean, Gothenburg is not the easiest place to get around in.
Right.
It's a port where big ships and steelworks operate. It's not like Zurich or Oslo or the big place in London. So, I mean, it was just one of those nights.
Now, and after that, did it make a big difference in terms of appearance fees, in terms of how you were respected by meet directors? You must have been in higher demand than you'd ever been.
Well, the appearance fees weren't talked about in those days.
Oh, that's right. Everything was under the table, right?
Yeah, I mean, I got $600 and a ticket to nowhere that I couldn't use. And a vase. That was what I got for the world record. So if you broke the world record today and did that sort of significant time...
Oh, $1 million.
You'd be rewarded with millions.
Oh, yeah. No question about it.
But anyway, that's why I didn't run for the millions. I ran because I wanted to run.
Well, in talking to Rodney, it sounds like the two of you traveled together through Europe and just had great times.
But basically what I had to do, Bob, was concentrate on the Olympics because... A lot of people ran world records prior to winning gold medals.
Right.
And couldn't emulate in the next year. So the biggest problem is once you become a little bit more famous, everybody wants a piece of you.
Right. So more demands on your time, yeah.
So I had to say, no, if I don't win the Olympics, I'm going to be a failure. So I've got to, for the next year, I've really got to concentrate on that. So that's what I did.
And that's so hard, too. You look at so many athletes like Steve Scott, who had a phenomenal career, but he doesn't have that Olympic medal. And it makes a difference when you look at, you know, people who are in the know, like yourself or Dixon, people who are in the sport, they know who the great guys were in between the Olympics. But unless you've got that medal, sometimes people look back at your career and go, well, what actually did you win?
Well, Steve Scott was probably one of the most underrated athletes anywhere in the world. He was so tough.
Yeah.
And he produced times. I paced him one night, not deliberately, but I was getting on a bit in the years. I was 32 years of age. And I ran a mile in Oslo, and the pace started off fairly slow. There was no natural pacemaker, so I took up the lead. And with 300 meters to go, he was sitting on me, and I was starting to get very tired.
Yeah.
And he waited too long to get past me. And Steve recorded the fastest time in America we ever run, 3:47.7.
Right.
And I said to him, why didn't you go past me? He said, I thought you were going to come back at me. I said, Jesus, I was stuffed. But I ran 3:49 flat that night. At 32, so it shows you I didn't run fast enough when I was 23.
God. Now, did you have many encounters? Did you race against Prefontaine much? Did you step up and run that? Because he was more of a 5,000, 10,000 guy, right?
Prefontaine was a character. I was just coming into athletics when I met Prefontaine.
Yeah.
I saw his movie, and it was a damn shame that he died.
Right.
But I was at a meeting one night in Italy.
Yeah.
There was 20,000 people there, and Prefontaine was under the world record for 5,000 meters. And he got to the 3,500 K, and he pulled off the track. And the crowd went silent, and I said to him afterwards, when he was having a cigarette and a beer, I said, why did you do that? He said, they only paid me enough to run 3,500 meters.
Oh, no way!
So that was Prefontaine.
That was Prefontaine. That totally sums up Prefontaine.
Yeah, he was a man of his own making.
How about Henry Rono? Did you have much contact with him?
Yes, I did. Henry Rono was probably so far ahead of his time; it wasn't funny.
He was amazing.
Four world records, but he was an alcoholic.
Yep.
And he was just a sad case of an epitomized an athlete, a bit like George Best, the late George Best.
Right, right.
So much talent, and yet not channeled in the right direction. I used to watch Henry Rona come to London, out of shape, running 14:50 for 5,000 metres.
Right.
2 months later, running the world record. He would just go down to the track and run lap after lap after lap after lap and get himself fit. He was so talented, but a great shame.
Yeah.
He could have been one of the greatest marathon runners around.
Oh, no question. No question. Now, John, did that, seeing what Rodney accomplished as a marathoner, did that ever interest you to take a step up that way, or... That seemed like a long way.
No, the furthest I ran was half marathon. I ran 1 hour, 1 for half.
Wow.
Which is pretty decent.
That's pretty decent, 101? Yeah, I think so.
But I never trained for a marathon. I trained like a marathon runner.
Well, yeah.
But Rod was so tough. I mean, I trained with Rod many times on the distance over the hills, but I could never keep with him. He was too strong.
He told one story where you two ran with Prefontaine, I think, one time, where you two just take turns surging on him and Pre would surge, and then you two guys would take turns surging, and he didn't quite realize it was two against one.
Yeah, but we were flat out, and he didn't realize it.
That is funny. Now, when you first met Arsh Jelly, and he asked you about what your training was, and you were, what, 17, 18 years old, at that point, you were just racing on the weekends. You really didn't train in between, right?
From the age of 7 to 17, I never trained.
Just raw talent.
I ran to and from school, ran a bit of cross country on the weekends, and that was about it. But But the kids in those days, Bob, were a lot fitter than they are today. They don't sit around watching computers or have the politically correct where you get an ABC or for jumping or running or whatever.
Right. Well, yeah.
First was first, and you ran.
You ran everywhere.
You were getting to school.
You ran. You played. You played soccer. You played football, and you ran all the time.
I played tennis. What I used to do is I used to run 10 miles to the tennis court, play tennis for 4 hours, and run home again.
Oh, my God.
So that was a means of getting to tennis. It wasn't a means of running. It was just the only way I knew how.
And if you look back at a lot of the guys from interviewing Steve Jones and Rod Dixon, running was just something you did. It wasn't something as a career. Nobody thought of it at that point. You did it for love. And it was a means of transportation.
I started off as a cross-country runner.
Right.
And I never thought I was going to go to the Olympics because I thought they didn't have cross-country in the Olympics, so there was no way I was ever going to go to the Olympics. That's as far as I thought.
Sure. But Arch Jelly saw something different in you.
He saw something raw and natural, and the thing is with Arch Jelly, he could get the best out of anyone. And, I mean, he always believed, and, I mean, he was a great motivator by writing letters. Lydiard was the spoken word who used to address people with spoken word. Arch Jelly was an English major, and he used to write extraordinary long letters. And every time you're in Norway or Finland or somewhere like that by yourself and you're sort of a little bit doubtful, you just bring out one of Arch's letters and read it, and it's really inspiring.
Wow. So you would carry his letters with you?
Yes, I carried them with me because they were so inspiring. And he made you believe in yourself. And when it comes down to it, everybody arrives on the track equal,
right,
at the Olympic Games.
Right.
And it's the person who wants to believe in himself more than anything else, and the one who wants it more, and the one who takes a risk and prepared to put himself in the race to win, that's the one who wins.
Again, we're speaking with running legend John Walker, the first athlete to break 3:50 in the mile, 1976 gold medalist at Montreal at the 1500 meters. Did you care, John? Do you remember reading any of Arch letters the night before the Olympics when you won the gold?
Yes, I did. Arch was actually with me at the Olympics in 76.
Yeah.
But strangely enough, in 1974, when I sort of had my big breakthrough in the big race against Thorbert Bay.
Yes.
I was a 3:38.3 1500-meter runner, and Arch came to me that night, and he said, "You'll break the world record tomorrow." I said, "Arch, that's a five-second improvement. I can't do it." He said, "You will." And I did. But, I mean, that was the ability of the man. He could assess. I mean, he could have coached me as a four-minute miler,
right,
as much as I probably would have gone.
Right. So, basically, you guys were a team. Without him...
We're a team for 20 years, and
wow,
we still respect him today.
Did he change your training a lot? What I hear from when you talk about great coaches, coaches change and adapt, obviously, to age, obviously, to the goal at hand. When you look at this, well, 70, when you look at 76, you were also in the 800, but it looked like that you sort of bagged the 800 to focus on the 1500.
Well, the thing is, it was 15 days from the time I arrived in the village to the end of it.
Right.
And that was a long time without races, so we decided we'd run two rounds of the 800. I'd already run 1:45.6 prior to the Olympics.
Right.
And I was going to run the first two rounds and deliberately go out in the second round, but as it was, I went out in the first round. I sort of goofed off a little bit, and I got out-sprinted and only got through, so it turned out to be a blessing. But what it did was it got me through the tunnel, got me through onto the track. It gave me a chance to compete in a big stadium of 85,000 people.
Right.
And when I was ready for the 1500, I was ready for it.
So there was no surprises on that day?
No, I was ready to break the world record that day of the Olympics. I mean, I could have run 3:31 anything.
But the way the Olympics plays out, it's a tactical race. You have to play with what the other guys do. It makes no sense for you to go off the front.
Which made it harder.
Right.
If it had been a flat-out race, I would have won by 30, 40 meters. But
right,
the fact that the race was slow, it became more tactical, and it was much harder to race.
Well, yeah, because then you've got two 800 guys there with less than 800 to go. Two specialists that you had.
And Eamon Coghlan, of course, he was the indoor champion as well. And
right.
He was very good. He was pretty quick.
Well, and they started talking about Eamon going there the last few days before the 1500. Everybody started talking about Eamon could win this. Eamon Coghlan could win this. So,
I got a letter from his coach.
Yeah.
Trying to psych me out.
Oh, really? What did he do?
Telling me that I couldn't win and that Coghlan was the man, I'd never run against him and watch out for him because he's going to beat my ass.
Really?
So, I mean, it didn't work, but, I mean, he tried hard.
You know, when I look back at that era with you and Steve Scott and Eamon Coughlin and those great indoor track meets, and, you know, the Jack-in-the-Box games that we had here in San Diego and Sun-Kissed up in L.A., and there was what I loved about it was the personalities and the fact that, you guys went head-to-head and weren't asking for, well, you need to put a two-mile in, and I don't want to race against people who who might beat me, that you guys weren't afraid to go head-to-head night after night after night.
No, we were stupid. we didn't know when to say no. But it was great comradeship, because the thing is, Eamon was the king of the boards. He was tough, and he saved San Diego so many times with the world record.
Right.
And the fastest I ever ran in San Diego was 3:52.2.
Well, indoors, that's pretty amazing.
Which wasn't bad for me. But, I mean, he was just one heck of a competitor, and Steve on his day could beat anybody, I mean.
No question.
But, I mean, I enjoyed coming to the States and running indoors, even though I was probably a bit too heavy for indoors. Yeah, Eamon was probably the right build.
He was perfect. He was smaller. He can fly. And Steve ran so upright. He ran so fast indoors, but you're going, God, he doesn't look like he's set up for the boards.
No, but he was strong. And the thing is, after the race, we'd all go and have a beer, and that's what it was all about.
Absolutely.
Today, the athletes go and lock themselves in a room and too frightened to eat or drink or do anything.
Now, what was the setup with when you and Dixon roomed together? Who bought the beer, and who put the beer in the bathtub?
Dixon arranged that. That was my reward for breaking the world record. I came back to a full bath full of beer.
Yeah.
And the incredible thing is, when my reward from Adidas, which was the shoe manufacturer,
yes,
I just broken the world record in the Adistar 2000. It was the new prototype, wasn't even on the market.
Right.
I had no shoe contract. And Rod and I went to the Adidas and afterwards and said, well, what's the deal? And they said, well, you can come and drink the bar dry it in Germany. So they flew us back to Germany, and Rod was quite happy that he didn't care about any money. And did he drink it dry?
Oh, my God. And you guys went head-to-head a lot of times, you and Rod.
We did.
And
we did.
You usually got...
I had the psychological edge over Rod a little bit.
Did you?
I used to psych him out a little bit a couple of nights before the race, and I'd try and get him out of the race, because on any given day, Rod could beat me.
Right. So what would you do to psych him out?
I would go to the track and run a 300 meters, and I'd say to him, Rod, I'll take the first little bit. You come up to my shoulder, and we'll cruise the last 100 meters.
Yeah.
But psychologically, I wouldn't allow him to cruise, because I'd be flat out, and he'd get up to me, and I'd try and kick again, and I'd get about a meter on him, and he'd say to me, God, if you're cruising, I don't think I'm right. I better run the mile. I better run another race. little did he realize I was actually flat out trying to keep him out of the race.
And smiling like, oh, yeah, this is easy. And,
exactly.
John, it's what a wonderful career. When you started out running with Arch, and would you have ever thought that you'd have such a long career and you'd accomplish what you accomplished?
No, well, I ran until I was 40 years of age, and that was probably the biggest disappointment. I wanted to run a sub-4-minute mile at 40.
Right. And you ran 135 sub-4-minute miles.
Yes, I did.
Wow. 135.
That was very unfair on Steve, because I got up to the United States and he said to me, we're even. And I said, no, Steve, I've just run 6 in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Sub-4-minute miles. But the thing is first, and you run to set the goal, and that's it.
That's what you try to do. When did you know that, okay, it's going to be tough for me to stay competitive at a world-class level? Was there one race where you just knew it's time to start looking for something else?
Yeah, well, I stayed around in athletics too long, but I stayed around there because I loved racing. I was a bit like Oviedo. Oviedo would have run till he's 60 if he could have.
Right, he loved it.
But I mean, the meat promoters retire you automatically anyway. But, I mean, today you couldn't run for that long because the competition is so tough.
It really is.
And it's all television, it's all money, so, I mean, it's totally different.
Now,
but I knew towards the end that I was getting to the end of it, because the thing is, I couldn't get nervous anymore. I was just going through the motions, and I knew it was all over.
When you didn't have the butterflies, you knew. The butterflies in your stomach. Yeah, that's
a bit like getting on the stage and doing a speech. If you haven't got a little bit of tension, a bit of butterflies, you know you're not going to do a good job.
Right, if it becomes too commonplace.
Yeah, but the thing is, the reason why I hung on was because I wanted to run right up to 40 to try and break 4 minutes. I think I could have run 3:55 at 40.
Oh, yeah.
Because I did a time trial about a week before on the road, and I ran 4:01.
Oh.
Just on the road. And I was running, I ran 10 quarters in 56, so I knew that I was in pretty reasonable shape.
And then what? Did you get injured?
Yeah, I pulled my Achilles.
Oh, God.
Trying to outdo the young guys.
Right.
Trying to show off.
Well, I know Rod was still, when he was going to turn 50, he was trying to do something. He wanted to get back on the track.
But pretty tough.
Yeah, it's still, and that's the hard part. He said, you know what, I can go out and have workouts like I used to, but now I got to recover for 3 days afterwards.
Yeah, the problem is you've got to do it right up to the day. You can't afford time off and come back again.
No, you're right.
But Bob, they were great years, and the thing is, athletics has changed today. Track and field's changed, and I don't think it's changed for the better.
Right.
I was in Europe last year at a reunion. The athletes are stony-faced. They don't talk. They don't have a beer. They don't eat the right food. They're so preconceived about their race. They think about everything else bar. And, I mean, you've got to relax and enjoy it because it's too short. And at the moment, it's just money and just racing and pacemakers. And it's actually quite boring.
I
sat there in Rome watching the races, five pacemakers going single file, and I thought, where's the race? Where's the excitement of five guys coming off the bend running flat out down the straight? But of course, what happens is these guys get into championship races in the Olympics and the Commonwealth Games or Europeans, and they run 3:31 or 3:30 in the heat in their pre-races, and they get put out in 3:43 because they've never learned to race.
Right. Yeah, they don't know.
But what I'm saying is the guys today, if they'd run against me in the Olympics in 76 on a tactical race, they wouldn't know how to do it.
No, not at all.
Because they're only conditioned to running fast.
And they don't race against each other enough.
And just because you run fast, I knew many, many guys that could run very fast.
Right.
But never won a race.
Yeah, not a big race.
No.
Yeah, it's a different game. When you've got Rod Dixon and Eamon Coughlin and Steve Scott and Bailly and all these guys, and you're used to going head-to-head with them, you learn how to race, or you don't last very long.
That's right. And it was fun.
Yeah, well, that's what it sounds like. From talking to Rod, it just sounds like you guys just had the best time traveling the world and going head-to-head with the best people and meeting people like, you know, hanging out with a Prefontaine and Steve Scott and Eamon Coughlin and all the running legends. And I think the one thing that connects all you guys is that you loved it. And it's real obvious to tell anytime I talk to any of you guys that how much you love doing what you did.
You got to love it. I mean, if you're just going in it for the money, you got the wrong way of going.
It's too hard.
You got to love the sport. No one makes you go out and train. And the thing is, you've got to put in the graft. And it's one of the best sports in the world. It still is, because I say to any young kid, all you need is a pair of running shoes, a short, and a T-shirt, and off you go. And if you want to wish for the dreams and aim for as high as you want to go and do the work, you can be anything you want.
John, who was the toughest guy you raced against?
Well, I raced through about four eras.
Yeah, that's right.
I came through my own era, which Philbert Bailly was, of course.
Right.
And then I came through the Ovette Coe era. And then came Steve Scott, so I ran against them all. They were all tough. Probably the classic example was Coe. He was probably the most gifted athlete for the lot. Cram on his day.
Yeah.
Could have beaten anybody, and so could have Ovette. Ovette wasn't a very confident athlete, even though he was quite arrogant and appeared like he was. But deep down, he was not as confident as Coe. Coe was very confident. And on his day, Cram was majestic. If he'd remained injury-free, he could have been anything. And now let's not forget the late Eva Van Damme, who came in the Olympics in 76 and took two silver medals.
Right.
He unfortunately got killed in a car accident 30 years ago. But he could have been a great athlete, too. And maybe if he'd come along, Ovette and Coe wouldn't have been as powerful as they would have been.
Wow. God. John, thank you so much for taking some time. I really, really enjoy chatting and going down memory lane a little bit. Now, how is your health?
My health is manageable.
Okay.
And it's manageable. I take a lot of tablets these days.
Right, and this is for Parkinson's?
Yeah, unfortunately I was diagnosed when I was 41 years of age with Parkinson's. But I manage it, and I still go to work, and I do a lot of things, and I keep very busy. I sit on city council as well.
Right.
I get a little bit tired from time to time, but I make sure I get out of bed every day and go and do something. I'm a little bit fortunate that I haven't got Parkinson's as bad as Muhammad Ali or people like that.
Right.
And I manage it quite well, but, I mean, who knows what the future's going to be.
Good for you. Well, John, thank you so much for taking time. Wonderful to catch up with you. I've followed your career forever and ever, and obviously a big fan. And love whenever Rod Dixon comes on, he doesn't hesitate to tell John Walker stories and talk about how you owned him, no question about that. He always talked about that. John, thank you so much, sir.
Thanks, Bob.
All right.
Appreciate it.
John Walker, the first man to break 350 for the mile.